Welcome to Nourish and Shine, where I talk with passionate leaders in the fields of nutrition, functional and integrative medicine, and wellness, providing inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and live a whole, vibrant life starting now. So I had been vegetarian and vegan and pescatarian and all sorts of other things on and off since about eighth grade, but mostly ate a really healthy diet that was primarily vegetarian until this last pregnancy when I developed gestational diabetes. I was testing my blood sugar about four times a day and found that I was having a really hard time controlling it. At that point, I decided that I was going to start eating a little bit of meat and see how it went. So I did a ton of research and came across Together Farms. They're one of the only places I found that I really, really felt good about what they were doing with their animals, how they raised them, what they fed them. And we're going to go into all of that in this episode. I'm so excited to share with you Stephanie Schneider today from Together Farms. She's going to talk about Burger Night, which they have during the summer, and I highly, highly, highly encourage everyone to go out to and see their beautiful farm and taste their amazing burgers. But we also get into a lot of the nutrition of eating meat and how animals are raised, what some of the terminology means, and so much more. I hope you really enjoy this episode. Welcome, Stephanie Schneider, to the Nourish and Shine podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. I'm hoping you can tell our audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm excited to be here too, Amy. So Stephanie Schneider, Together Farms, we raise meat on our farm. We have a seasonal restaurant. I have two young daughters. Well, they seem to grow every day, so they're not quite as young as I think they are anymore. And married with my husband, we do the farm together. And now the farm is my only thing. It's my only job. So big, exciting things are happening here, and it's all going to develop, and I'm really excited to see where this year, next year or two goes for us. So we have Together Farms, and that's kind of the nutshell. I can Great. Expand a lot more.
Yeah. So let's start kind of at the beginning. How did you even decide, how did you decide to become a farmer? Because that wasn't originally what you were doing, right? And can you talk a little bit about your background as far as what you went to school for?
Yeah, well, the background's easy. So I went to Northern College and I got my undergrad in natural resources and a few other things. And then I got my master's degree at UWGB in environmental science and policy. So I kind of always had an environmental bent. And actually what I always thought that I was going to do was to be on my family's cheese factory and maybe be in the cheese part a little bit, but really on the other end of cheese making, which is dealing with wastewater treatment and all of the things that, there's big, cool environmental things you can do with wastewater and that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's what I thought I was going to do. And I ended up selling it while I was in college. And so then I kind of had to flitter and flutter about for a while, trying to figure out who I was and what my identity was now that I lost this huge part of me, and ended up in government with DNR. And I was there for a little bit and then went to DAGCAP, and I was with DAGCAP for quite a few years, which is the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection for the state of Wisconsin. And then while I was there, I got transferred. And when we moved, we had to find property to buy. And because we were moving for my job, we only had a small, tiny period of time to find one within commuting distance. And there just really are not always a lot of farms up for sale. And we also had two tiny children. My youngest one was 4 or 5 months old. My oldest one then was three or four years old. So we needed to go into a house that was move-in ready. And if you're ever in the farm market, that immediately takes out probably 60% of the farms, because their houses usually are pretty neglected, the ones that we could afford anyway. So we ended up buying a piece of property we're currently on, and we didn't have any intention of starting a meat business or doing, our real goal was, well, we just want to find a rural piece of property that we can raise our kids on in a rural place. And we had been in Madison for 2 years and looking that entire 2 years, but it was totally impossible to find anything within commuting distance of Madison with any kind of acreage. So we were really excited when I got transferred. And we ended up on this farm in 60 acres. And then I actually had the dream to maybe start a sheep dairy operation on the farm and make cheese, have my own little farmstead cheese making operation, because I still really, really missed it. I just missed that whole part of my life. And we spent a lot of money. I spent a lot of time. I went to all the classes. It was a lot. And we're kind of in the final stages of, all right, now we pull the trigger and we start building stuff. But we went to visit a bunch of other sheep farms and came to the realization that when it's a farmstead dairy, you know, it's one or two people. Usually you have one cheesemaker, and that licensed person is the only one that can ever make cheese. So if I ever wanted a break, I would have to hire someone to come in and do the work. And I also came to the realization during this time that a farmstead operation is 1,000 times different than what I grew up on. And I was just going to basically be in a little room all by myself all day doing dishes, because making cheese is like 90% doing dishes and a tremendous amount of patience. And those are all things I didn't want. You know, I was in the government world. I was already in the cubicle, which I didn't like. This was just like going to be a stainless steel and concrete cubicle, which kind of sounded worse. And then washing dishes all day. So needless to say, the little sheep farmstead dairy dream floated away. And in the meantime, we were raising a couple of meat animals for ourselves. You know, we had bought a couple of beef cows. We had bought a couple of sheep, had the chickens running around, a couple of pigs, and that was going pretty good. I mean, we were doing it and it was great. And we thought to ourselves, well, you know, if you're going to raise 3 pigs, how much more work is it to raise like 10, right? Because you're still doing the same amount of chores. You're still doing, the chores doesn't change, but you'd have more product to sell. So then you would be able to sell enough to at least pay for the cost of maybe raising your own, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the logic is there and the logic seems logical. But once you start actually doing it, there's kind of some big steps that happen, because in order to sell the meat from 8 other pigs, that means you have to go to a farmer's market. And if you want to go to a farmer's market, well, now you have to build your little booth, and you have to get all your licenses. There's so many licenses. And you have to you still have to jump through all these hoops, whether you're selling 5 pigs at the market or 500, right? So we underestimated kind of the amount of time and effort it would take to.
One of the things I'm curious about is you kind of seem to really follow your instinct as you went and kind of try things, but not get too attached, and then like try something else and like an open mind as you were going. Did you have any moments of like, oh man, like this is it? Like once you started raising the animals, or how did you like actually start to know like you were on the right track?
Well, that's kind of a good question. I think we kind of knew we were on the right track because nothing else was really working very well. And we just kept so we would try these different things and either we wouldn't like it or it just wouldn't go real well. But in the background, you know, the meat stuff was just always happening. And then at one of the farmers markets, I had some customers that really loved us and really wanted to support us and buy our products, but they didn't know how to cook it. So I remember this lady one time said to me, okay, Steph, I'm going to buy this beef roast from you, but just so you know, I have no idea what I'm doing. So I'm going to have to go home and like Google how to make this beef roast. And it was a little bit of a eureka moment for me, because I realized, you know, my customers are kind of, they want to support me. They're paying more, right, than a beef roast in a grocery store to support me. But then they are inconveniencing themselves by doing so, which is a really probably not a very sustainable business model, because so many people just don't really know how to cook anymore, you know? That's when I realized, because of course we were trying to do this farm. I had two small children. I'm doing farmers markets on the weekend. We drastically underestimated how much time had to be devoted to an infant, you know, when you're trying to do a farm. Like if I'm gone at the farmers market, Andy can't be building fences because then he's got to be holding the baby. And this whole entire time we've always had off-farm jobs. So, you know, it was nights and weekends. And what I was doing then during that time in order to be able to eat supper, I was making freezer meals. So there, I would just put the raw ingredients in a bag and then I would freeze it. And then the whole bag of stuff, just raw, right? So then the whole bag of raw food just gets put in the slow cooker and cooked. And that's it. You just dump it in and then you go. And I thought, you know, maybe if I'm making all of those for myself, I could find a commercial kitchen to rent and I could make extras that someone else could use. But, and that worked out. Finding a commercial kitchen is a little bit of a chance, like, you know, doing all that in the background of also farmers market, day job, children, farm, took forever. We really underestimated how long all these things would take to get off the ground. But it was a great thing, and it is a great thing. And I'm going to actually be developing those a lot more now that I'm on the farm full time. I have big ideas for how to take those kind of to the next step. And, you know, I would like to point out that I started doing that before Blue Apron was even on the scene. Like,
yeah,
I feel like there's a really big missed opportunity there. I should have marketed and branded a little better.
Yeah, well, it's such a smart idea. And I think it's a really neat way to kind of connect your product and make it like more accessible and easy to use for people who want to eat healthy, like well-raised meat. But
don't know how to cook it.
Don't know how to cook it. Yeah.
Or have the time or the interest in learning.
Yeah. Well, I found personally, as someone who's bought meat from you, like for me, I used to be vegetarian. So like I never cooked meat since eighth grade on. And then when I was pregnant, I ended up having gestational diabetes and decided to start eating meat, but I wanted to eat really high quality meat and like grass fed and organic and all that. And so I searched you guys out and I found you. And then I like bought a bunch of meat. And then you kind of have this moment of like, oh my gosh, what do I do with all of this?
Yeah, right. Now I have this freezer full of weird cuts of meat that I don't do. So actually one thing that I did for that is like if people get a quarter of a cow or a half of a pig, I have an ebook that I put together that walks them through the steps of how to have it cut up, right? Like, what do you tell the butcher? A lot of people have never done that before. And then recipes that go along with every cut of meat that you would get back with that, using those cutting instructions. And because nobody wants a mystery meat to be in their freezer. And every time they open their freezer, and it has my name on it. So then every time they open their freezer, they see this package of round steak, and then they're like, you know, like have this like anxiety. I gotta do something with that. I don't know what to do with that. I gotta, so it becomes almost like a pain point or a negative. And so anyway, I'm just trying to like help people kind of get over that. And then most of the meals too can be freezer meals. So my idea was, you know, people can get a quarter or a half of a cow, and then they could immediately turn half of it, because you can do freezer meals, you can make a lot in a day. They could turn half of it into freezer meals and then leave the cuts that they know how to cook, right? Like maybe the steaks, maybe the ground beef. They could leave that out and do whatever they want to do with those, and then be able to just dump the other ones in the slow cooker when they're ready. So I try really hard to give people the information and tools that I think that they'll need to not have mystery meat with my name on it.
Oh yeah, totally. So one of my other questions for you, because you can tell just by reading your website and kind of how you raise animals and everything, that you have like a pretty strong interest in health and nutrition. And how did you develop that interest?
Well, I developed it, I think, the way that most people do. I, you know, after talking and interacting with so many people for so long at markets and stuff, it really seems like there's one of two ways that people start to care about nutrition, and it's either they have children or they develop a health problem and they want to fix it. So in my case, it was really that I had children, right? Because you can know the right things to do. You can know what you shouldn't eat. You could know that you should be, you can know all of these things, but it really takes some kind of catalyst to push you over that hurdle, because there's always kind of a pain with change, right? So to push you over and through that takes something. And in my case, it was having kids. But I always knew what I should be. I mean, we all know, like if we only did what we already know to do, we would all be thin and healthy. And
that's such a good point.
But executing and actually changing our patterns of behavior and doing it usually takes some kind of outside or pressure. And so, yeah, so for me, it was kids. And especially when you don't live by big grocery stores, you just have so many, you're so limited in the options. And even if you don't look at exactly how the meat was raised, right? So like, even if we don't care about the animal's life, what the animal ate, any of that stuff, and we're just reading the ingredient label on the package, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a small store. I mean, now things have really changed in the last year, couple of years, because we can order everything online. But even then, still, it's really hard to find meat that doesn't have, I just call it weird stuff because that seems to be the easiest way to say it. But, no unpronounceable ingredients, no chemicals. Like the reason they add all of those chemicals to conventional meat is because they have to, because that meat, well, one, they've changed these animals so that they grow so fast that they don't have any time to develop any flavor at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the meat has no flavor and it has no fat. And then it's going to probably sit in, it's got to go through the slaughterhouse. It's got to sit on a truck to get transported to some box store somewhere. It's got to, it just goes through all these steps of like sitting places. And mm-hmm. So of course they have to add all these preservatives. And of course the grocery stores want it to last as long as possible on their shelves so that they can sell it eventually. So it's just a totally different paradigm than ours. We don't need any of that stuff because we're not sitting on semi-trucks. We're not sitting on grocery shelves for weeks. We're just going in our freezer and then going in your freezer. Like, so it's pretty simple and straightforward.
Which is amazing. And that's one of the things I wanted to get at was, how is Together Farms different? So for people who have never been there or don't know your model, can you tell me about how you guys raise your animals differently?
We are raising our beef and our lamb are 100% grass-fed. Our sheep get moved every week or so. Our cattle get moved every day, of course, in the summer when grass is growing. And what we're doing by doing that is we're forcing them to eat a very diverse diet, because the cow, when they're next to each other, they don't want the other cow to get the grass, right? So they're going to kind of be in competition with each other to eat as much as they can and to get all the good stuff. And of course, to fill their bellies as much as they can. And so we force them to eat everything, not just pick out the best things, because we're moving them through fast. And that means that they're getting a really diverse diet. So that means that they have a much higher mineral nutritional profile, because they're not just locked in a barn eating only GMO corn all day, right? And then with our pigs, it's kind of similar again. They don't get moved as often as the cattle do, but we have paddocks in our woods. And because we're in the driftless area of Wisconsin, we have these really tremendous amount of diversity. And one of my happiest days was when I was walking the property, I found wild hazelnuts growing. And I was
how
so excited.
Cool.
And so, well, clearly, with all of these big oak trees, wild plums, wild apples, like wild elderberries everywhere, plus we have hazelnuts, like this is perfect for the pigs. And of course, they love it. And it's great. And what we're trying to do is, once things kind of settle down now, we just are kind of coming out of the startup phase of our farm again. It takes so much longer than you ever dreamed it's going to. Now that we're kind of out of the startup phase, now we're going to start into our efficiency phase. So our intention is to convert this farm to a permaculture farm. It's very, very sandy. So when we don't get rain for a week, you know, we kind of start to notice it already in all the plants. So what we want to do is put in a series of berms and swales and get all of our water to soak in. Our goal will be to not let any water that comes onto our farm leave our farm. And then where we put our berms and swales, then we're also going to plant those areas, because the roots of perennials can then tap into where we're soaking that water in. So then those areas are going to be planted full of hazelnuts, you know, things that start producing nuts and calories for pigs and animals within a short period of time, and then intermixed with chestnuts, oak trees, you know, things that'll take longer, but so that we have kind of an eye on the future of, you know, leaving a bit of a legacy and something that basically is setting this farm up so that it can be highly, highly productive forever. And so, okay, so that's their food and forage side of things. And then we have the supplements and stuff that we give them. So I think a lot of people have heard of apple cider vinegar now and know about all the health benefits for us personally to take it, and how nutrient dense it is, and that it's a great cleanser, that it's just a good digestive aid, you know, it just has all of these really great health promoting benefits to it. So one of the things that we do is we pump apple cider vinegar into the water line for the animals, so that every time they're drinking water, they're getting a tiny bit. It's not Bragg's, but it's basically exactly the same stuff. It has the mother in it. It has, you know, all of the good, very similar to what we would buy off of the grocery store shelf. So that goes into the water line. And it's funny because when you're on a farm like this, where you're just kind of doing things totally differently, you know, you're paying attention to the land, and you're paying attention to how the animals are doing on the land. And then, of course, you know, you're working with nature, and it's just a totally different model that equipment does not exist. Like, you can't go buy it because there's so few people doing it that there's not a market. So nobody is going to like develop these, but that is changing a little bit. So there is a little more availability now. But what we actually did for this vinegar is we bought a doser that is, so its intended purpose is actually to dose into the water lines medication for pigs in conventional barns, because those pigs are so stressed out. Their genetics are exactly identical. So they want to die, right? So anytime, they have to be protected in this bubble. You know, that's another reason that people are not allowed to go in those buildings, is because if they catch something, they'll die. They just, and they'd all get it because they're all the same DNA. Because they're just, the only goal is maximum meat production per square foot. That's what CAFOs do. Besides dairy CAFOs, those are a little different. But pig CAFOs, chicken, that's all what they're designed to. So anyway, so they got to give them medication to tell their bodies, no, we don't want you to die yet, you know, kind of force them to stay alive. But we have taken that and we have turned it into an instrument for good, and are using it to put vinegar in our lines. And then, of course, they get high quality minerals, sea salt, and, you know, just those couple of things, and fresh air and sunshine. And we really hardly have any problems at all with sickness or disease. So it's pretty fantastic. Our vet bills are almost nothing. Our vet bills for our dogs are higher than it is for our 300 animals.
That says a lot.
Yeah. To finish that thought too. Okay, yeah. So that's the production side. That's the meat. That's the part which, unfortunately, nobody has to put on the label when you go buy something. So when these pig CAFOs are putting, I don't remember how to pronounce the word, ractopamine or racto something into their feed, which is again, to trick them to grow faster, and is banned in most places, but not here. But it's clearly going to be in their meat, right? As are these subtherapeutic antibiotics, the hormones that they're given, but it's in the meat and they've been fed it their entire lives. And the same with parasites, insecticides on the outside of their skin, but a lot of them also get when they put it under the skin, they put it under the skin. So they're constantly getting doses of insecticides on them so that the flies and things like that don't bother them. None of that has to be put on the label. That's 100% on the consumer to do research to find out what's going on in the background. So that's really frustrating. But then we can talk about the stuff that's on the label. So one of the big bottlenecks in the meat raising world are butchers, because butchers are so busy already. They really don't want to stop the way that they're doing something to do something different for little old us, right? Because we're just going to slow everything down. So what we have to do after, I think I talked to, I interviewed like 15 or 20 different butchers and we took meat to some. And after all that, we decided on Conrath Quality Meats, which is up in Conrath, Wisconsin, which is almost 2 hours away from our farm. So we have some major costs when it comes to taking our animals in. But I can't take them to the local place and have them put MSG in there. I just spent so much time and effort, you know, making sure the meat part was right. So to us, it's totally worth it to kind of go the extra mile, literally, to make sure that we're using good products in the meat that we're made. It's literally, it's just meat and spices and seasonings. And there's nothing hidden in the seasonings either. It's, you know, it's just spice blends like we would do basically in our own kitchen. It's really no different. So we're pretty proud of that, and it's really, really a hard thing to find. And even, I even don't, you know, there's a lot of negativity out there about the celery juice, you know, how celery juice is used as a substitute for chemical nitrates, and butchers feel really weird and awkward about that usually. So what happens is they put in a ton to protect themselves. And so the variation in the amount of nitrates that can be in products processed with that, it can be significantly higher than if you would just buy the product with just the straight nitrates in it. So it's kind of a dirty little secret of this natural meat processing world, is that celery juice stuff is really not any different or any better, and actually can oftentimes be worse than if you just got it with the conventional nitrates or, yeah.
Wow, that's super interesting. So they're... I don't know too much about the celery juice piece. So they're putting celery juice in as like a natural nitrate, but they're actually using way more than what they would.
Right.
Otherwise. Okay.
Yes, because nitrates are naturally, or nitrites, I get it mixed up in my head, but they're naturally occurring in celery juice. So what they've done is I'm assuming they've just, you know, concentrated it and they add certain amounts of it to the blend. And you know, at the end of the day, our body, a nitrate is a nitrate. And so you can actually end up with way more with that. It's something to look into a little bit. I only, you know, read these things, and I've solved that problem for me. That what happens is I solve my little problems in my little world, and then I move on to the next thing. And then I forget all the, like, the whys and the wheres and the whos that were involved with getting me to that decision. But yes, so that is something that does deserve a little bit of attention or research. Yeah.
And so to go back just a little bit, so I know there's a lot of terms that get thrown around. Like, what's the difference between like grass-fed and pastured?
There wouldn't really have to be a lot of a difference between them. And there's a lot of mismarketing, a lot of greenwashing that goes on. So, you know, I often tell people that my real competition in this world is not the farmer next door who's also selling their meat directly. It's the big giant companies, you know, the Smithfields of the world that have unlimited, basically compared to me, have unlimited marketing and advertising budgets that can get people, can play with labels and colors and fonts to get people to think that they're buying a product that is similar to mine, but that it's not at all. they're basically two totally different products. So that's why with our beef and our lamb, we say that we are 100% grass-fed, because there are so many games being played in the grass-fed world, especially right now, because these beef producers saw that the grass-fed world can charge a premium for their product, because it takes way more labor, and it takes, there's a lot involved. And usually it takes a little bit longer to finish the animal. And you also have to spend a lot of time and money on making sure you're getting the right genetics. You're getting animals that can finish well on a grass-only diet. And everybody had been ignoring that for a long time, because if you just throw cattle on a corn diet, you know, you're just making them fat. When you feed cattle corn, their entire rumen changes totally. It's a completely different profile than if they're only eating forage or grass. So the comparison that I use for people is, it would be like if we were locked in a, you know, if we're in jail and the only thing that we eat is donuts, right? So they feed us donuts, and the first day it's like, oh, yum, I love donuts, this is great. But then you start to feel really crappy. You're like, okay, all right, I don't really want any more donuts. Like, thanks, but that's enough, right? So that's what would happen kind of in the cow world. Well, to get me to eat more donuts, what they would have to do is they would have to trick my body into thinking it's happy and then it's not sick. And again, that's why we get those, that's why they're feeding them antibiotics all day, every day, like in mixed in the feed, is because they have to turn off those signals in their body. Otherwise, they would quit eating. Like the same way we would just quit. Like, I literally cannot eat a donut today. You know, like, sorry, I need a salad. So that's the same thing that they do to these cattle in these feedlots, is trick their bodies into thinking they are still hungry so that they keep going and gaining weight. And when you're doing that, you can make basically any animal have fat in it, right? So that when it goes to be butchered, it comes out as a prime cut of meat, right? Like a high-end steak. But we can't do that in the grass-fed world. There's only so much grass you can put into a cow every day. And it can only be of so high of nutrition, right? You can only get so many pounds of weight gain on a cow every day on grass. And so you don't have those, like, you don't have those, I don't know what exactly to call them, but you have to get it right. Otherwise, it'll be noticed and product. So there's a significant amount of money that goes into that stuff too. Anyway, these big companies, you know, saw that there's quite a premium price that was being charged for grass-fed. And so when I've listened to people like from Thousand Hills Cattle Company and people that are just way more involved in the big volume grass-fed beef production, really know what's going on in the world, the marketing world, they've said that there's no way. The amount of grass-fed beef that's currently on the market, you know, a couple of years ago when it really spiked up and seemed to all of a sudden be everywhere, like, it's totally impossible for that much grass-fed beef to have suddenly been ready for market, because it takes longer and there's like big shifts you have to make in your production model. So instead, what's happened is the term grass-fed has kind of been hijacked. And if you put a cow on grass for any period of time, basically you can just say it was on pasture. And with some CAFOs, you can just have a door that is open that the chickens can go out of, and there's a pasture out there, grass lot, and then you can say that they're pasture, even though they'll never go out the door, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. It was there, so that's all that they need. So the other thing that's really interesting is people that grass-fed but then grain finish, because I've seen on Eat Wild are some really great infographics that show if you feed a cow grain for even 30 days, the amount of your whole omega-3, omega-6 ratio, which is one of the most beautiful parts of eating grass-fed beef, changes so that it's like that cow was just eating grain its whole entire life. Like, it does not take very long for that cow to be eating corn at all, because like I said, as soon as it starts to eat corn, that entire rumen, you know how cows have all those stomachs, and that's the reason cows can gain 3 pounds a day eating grass and we can't, unless of course we have it doused in fats and sugars and nuts and berries, right, on our salads. But the reason they can continue to gain weight on just grass is because their rumens are built to digest grass in a way that ours are not. same with pigs. Pigs are also not designed to gain weight on grass. So we feed them grass, but we supplement grain for them too. And of course, we get all the nuts and all that good stuff. But yeah, so because the rumen is changing so drastically, then that immediately, you know, kind of radiates out to their entire body. And now you took this product that was going to be a nourishing, health-promoting health product, right, of like, of the highest order. And you've immediately turned it into, I mean, it's better than feedlot beef probably, but you've just really undone most of the good that you had done. So it's really unfortunate, because if you can get the genetics right, then you don't have to do that grain finishing at the end. You can just finish on your pastures. So you have to be very careful. If it says grass-fed, if it says pastured, that can basically mean nothing, especially if it's a company where you can't talk directly to the farmer and find out what they're doing. And really disappointingly, I just found out that this farm, this newer one that kind of came online that's been at a farmer's market and stuff that we are involved with, we were shocked at how little they were charging for their grass-fed beef. And another farmer friend of mine saw their carcasses at the butcher that they're using and couldn't understand how they were able to get so much fat on that carcass. And then after talking to them, realized that, oh, it's because they're feedlotting them at the end of their life, but that's never indicated on their labels. It's never indicated. We think that they genuinely think that they are doing the right stuff and doing good. But it's just, unfortunately, the consumer can't be lazy. If they want to make sure that they're getting the right product, they have to ask questions and they have to know the right questions to ask. Now that I'm on the farm full time, I'm working on a document to help people with that, knowing how to navigate this crazy world. So that will be out hopefully by within the next 3 to 6 months. But it really is a jungle out there.
And just knowing the right questions to ask, I think, is so key. Yeah. And like being able to know the farmer and visit the farm. And I think that's what you guys really do differently is, I mean, with Burger Night, and we can talk about that, like people actually get to come out and like see how the animals are raised and see how they're living and be there.
Yeah. And I also we do a farm tour every Saturday at 2:30. So that's only during Burger Night. So it's only from May through October. But yep, we have a little wagon and we pull everybody around and we show them everything and talk about everything.
I love that transparency. And I think being able to actually see what's going on versus like, oh, everything's behind a closed door, like nothing to see here, it makes you feel a lot better as a consumer. And I think if people like the broader audience realize what was actually going on and like took time to research it, they probably would feel a whole lot different about the meat they're eating.
I agree. And, you know, so this one time I love breakfast and we were sold out of all of our breakfast stuff. So I ran to the little local grocery store, like, whatever, I don't even care. I just want to have some sausage. And it tasted so chemically, it tasted so bad that I literally could not eat it. I had to feed it to the dogs. It was horrible. And I think, you know, we just trained our palates to be so accepting of the fake flavors and the preservatives and everything, that once you get yourself off of that, you'll know it kind of as soon as you taste it with some of that stuff. But yeah, then the next part is just knowing the right questions to ask farmers. And one of the best ways to do that is to, I really trust the AGA certification, the American Grass-Fed Association. They have 100% grass-fed label. And that's one that we have, and because it means something. There's a lot of welfare labels out there. There's a lot of natural, sustainable. Sustainable is like the new greenwashing term. They don't mean anything. So also too, I wouldn't put too much stock into certifications until you go and look and see what those certifications actually entail and what the producers have to do to meet those. Because otherwise, some of them were purely solely created for the CAFO world, for the factory farms to be able to put a certification on their packaging, you know, that used the right words. And that's really happening with the word sustainable right now. what happened is over in Europe, the consumers got wise to some of this stuff, and they told the CAPOs, you know, look, or told their farmers, like, this is what sustainable is to us, and we want you guys to change to meet these requirements that, you know, that we would like in order to buy your product. Well, that was very offensive for them. So when our national pork boards and beef industries over here learned about that, they said, okay, we have to get out in front of this thing, and we have to define sustainable now on our terms, and then tell the consumers, this is sustainable. You don't have to worry about it. You know, some of our farmers are doing no-till, or some of our farmers are growing cover crops, but nobody had to actually change anything that they were doing. So it's really, certifications are starting to not mean a lot anymore. They've kind of become a tool, another tool for marketing that consumers have to look into and kind of understand, unfortunately.
That's so important to point out. And can we talk about the term organic too? I know there's a lot of confusion around that, and you do have organically raised animals, correct?
Yes, correct. Yep.
Yeah. So what's the difference with the term organic?
So that's another place. And I would encourage people to look into the Cornucopia Institute. They've done really a lot of watchdog type stuff with the organic advisory boards and the people that are making the decisions of what's allowed and not allowed in the organic world. We, again, because we were doing so much stuff and because we still have direct relationships with our customers, we didn't think it was necessary to pay, because it's very expensive to be organically certified, not only in terms of the amount of time that you have to put into paperwork and inspections and stuff, but there's also, and we didn't have the time. So then we were like, well, forget it. It's not worth it. But there's also a huge expense to it. Not only is there a fee to be organic, but I think they also get a percentage of your sales. You have to report how much you've sold, and then they get a percentage of that. And of course, immediately to most consumers, that should be a pretty big red flag, because there's a huge disincentive then for them to ever decertify big giant operations. Like CAFOs can be certified organic so long as they're buying certified organic feed, so long as they're not using, I mean, I think they can, right? They have to have like access to outdoors. I don't know all the rules exactly when you get into those really big operations, but it just wasn't the right fit for us, because we know, like, we don't hardly wholesale except for in our little local co-op, two of them that are within an hour, and then a restaurant in Eau Claire. So we still know everybody. We still are directly talking to all of our customers. So to me, that means more than a paper certification. And of course, because people can come out here and see everything. So so they can kind of know what's going on. And I can tell them the right questions to ask. Maybe that's a little bit backwards or upside down. But, you know, I think I kind of know. I know a lot about what other farms are doing to be able to, like I just kind of did, right? To be able to explain to people what I think they should care about and ask, you know, be asking about. Yeah. So I don't know if that explained it, but.
Kind of. I think so. But organic, like when it comes to animals, is more about what they're eating. Is that right? So like organic relates to their diet.
Yeah, so it means what they're eating. I think there is a requirement for them to have access to a certain amount of space. Whether it has to be indoors or outdoors, I'm not 100% sure. And for us, really, a lot of what the organic certification is it's not putting bad stuff into them or into the plants or whatever. But we are trying to really do a lot to put good stuff in, right? So, like, we're past the no weird stuff, no bad stuff. Our goal is not to not have bad stuff. Our goal is to have lots of good stuff and to be really nutrient dense and to be nourishing to people. Right.
And I think that's an amazing goal. And so my next question then, talking about kind of like weird or strange things, I know they didn't used to be, but anymore, you don't think a lot about organ meats. And with the whole like keto and paleo movement, it's kind of coming back around to have a renewed interest in the organ meats. Have you noticed that in your consumer base? And then if so, how do you tell people to prepare them?
So So, I mean, I have noticed it a little bit, but also I've been pushing the organ meats from day one, even before I think keto and paleo were words in our vocabulary. So there's a couple of different things. So, you know, of course, organ meats are going to have really different profiles to them than just, you know, the cuts of meat. And so nutritionally, I think people are realizing that it's really, if you really want to get maximum health benefits from a whole food diet, you should really eat the whole animal. So it's like whole animal, whole food diet. And I have lots of recipes. So like I mentioned earlier in some of the ebooks that I have several available for free, and I'm going to be developing that a lot more now that I'm around. And then I have, you know, the ones with the cutting instructions. Because of course, if you get a quarter or a half or whatever, you should always get the organs that you can get. And not all butchers and really not all of the inspectors, because every butcher plant has an inspector that is there from the government, that's there the entire time that they're processing. So not all inspectors will allow butchers to keep all the organ meats. So sometimes people get, I get a lot of questions about brains and, you know, stuff like that. And it's just not something that our inspector will let us keep.
Do they say why?
Well, I know with those in particular, there was the mad cow disease thing that happened and or is happening, or I don't know. But the mad cow disease is spread through contaminated spinal fluid, I believe. And so, of course, then that would mean that the brain would have it if they had it. But like, we're not feeding dead cows to our cows. So unlike in the CAFO world, where it's really just, it's pretty unbelievable what they feed to cattle in feedlots or any of the animals in those worlds. Our cattle are at zero risk for having it because they're never exposed to the spinal fluid of other cows, right? So it's ridiculous that they won't let us keep it, but it's just part of that, like, this weird world that we live in with our food that I've never really traveled out of country, but when you hear the stories about the foods they can have and, you know, what they can do for curing and sausages and charcuterie type stuff, like, it's amazing what they can do in other countries that our, like, stainless steel, sanitized, hand washed, gloved every 2 seconds world that we're living in just won't let us do. It's just all part of these meat rules. And then, of course, the preferences of inspectors or interpretations of individual inspectors, which is why it can also vary between counties or whatever in our state. So it's really, really frustrating. But so I give lots of recipes because, of course, organ meats usually sell a lot slower than ribeyes. And so there's some education that has to happen with the consumers or with anybody about how to cook them. And so I do give lots of recipes. And then we also make a couple of products that have the organs in them. Like, one of my favorites is the Braunschweiger that we have. And it's really hard to find Braunschweiger that doesn't have an ingredient list that's a mile long and 13 syllable words that you can't pronounce. And it's really, again, it's liver and it's bacon and it's spices and seasonings. And that's, you know, that's about it. And they use like honey for the sweetener. And so even the sugar and stuff is usually kind of above average. So like the Braunschweiger, you can just put on a cracker. Or one of my favorite ways to make it is I slice the chunk off and we use lard for all of our pan frying because it has a pretty high smoke point. And of course it's actually sustainable because we're raising it on our farm. So it's not some kind of weird imported oil, especially like they would use in a restaurant. And of course it's full of good fats and good things. Like, pigs that are raised outdoors have a tremendous amount of vitamin D because they're actually out in the sun. Of course, if a pig is never out in the sun, it'll never have any vitamin D. So when you're eating lard from pigs, I think Weston A. Price put out the number 10,000 international units per tablespoon. So really, if you get onto a whole food diet and you're sourcing meat from good sources, you really probably aren't going to have to buy a lot of those supplements anymore, right? Because you'll be getting it in your diet. But so what I do is I slice a chunk of Braunschweiger off and I fry it in a little pan with some lard. And then because there's bacon in it, right? So then you'll get like these little delicious crispy bits. And then I'll fry an egg in that same pan after I take it out. And the egg kind of like deglazes the rest of the little spicy bits that were left behind. And then you could eat it like open face on a sandwich, or you could just eat them like on top of each other. It's really good. So awesome. That's one of my favorite ways to eat Braunschweiger. And you don't even have to do hardly anything except eat it.
Could you share that recipe? Maybe I could put it in the show notes, or I can link to your blog.
Yeah, definitely.
That would be wonderful. So my next question then, I know you got into doing some skincare products and candles. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
So the reason that I got into like soap making and stuff was actually because I was having this lard problem and I had to solve it. I've really become quite the problem solver since we bought the farm, because I had all this lard. I didn't have a commercial kitchen, so I couldn't do anything with food. You know, this was before I ventured into the freezer meals, and someone had built a commercial kitchen in Eau Claire that you could rent. But before that, that didn't exist. And I know a lot of people say, well, churches have commercial kitchens. And well, that's kind of true. Also, now a lot of churches won't take on the risk or liability of letting people rent out their space. So that's kind of dried up as a source, which is too bad. But anyway, so I didn't have a commercial kitchen. So I couldn't do anything food consumable with all of this lard that I had. And then I discovered that I can make soap out of it. So soap is beautiful and it's perfect because it's like shelf stable. I don't even have to store it in my freezer, right? Like, and it's this beautiful thing that smells really, really good and it looks really good. And when I'm at farmers markets and stuff, people can see it and touch it and, you know, smell it. Unlike the meat, which is just frozen in a cooler and it's kind of hidden, right? So the soap was really great for that. But then it also turned out to just be a really amazing product. And I don't use only lard. I do, I kind of figured out, because lard is great, but it's not perfect, right? And it has some shortcomings when it comes to making, like it doesn't get real bubbly, but coconut oil gets really bubbly. So I do a mixture of lard and coconut, and olive oil is also just a good nourishing one. And it also makes it lather nicely. And then a little bit of grapeseed oil again, because it really is good for the skin. So I do a blend of all of those oils and it comes out to be a really, really great bar that I have a lot of repeat customers for it. And I actually don't really sell it out of any stores wholesale because everybody can just get it directly from me through our website or in our little farm store. And that's been enough because once they try it, it's really great. And so that's how I ended up going into the skincare world. But then once I got there, I also realized that there's a lot of other really great stuff that I can make. And what we are doing by using fats that we grow here is we are replacing palm oils, or replacing canola oils, or replace, you know, like, because also we use our lard in our deep fryers in our kitchen for burger night, whereas most restaurants are going to be using some kind of weird fryer oil, which is like canola, soybean, I don't know, and it goes through all kinds of processes that we probably don't want to know about, but I'm sure they're not good for us, that, you know, get the oil to be as stable as possible so they don't have to change it very often, and be able to get up to like 450, 500 degree smoke points, you know, and so it's just not something that we should be eating. But also if you go backwards and look at how those products are growing, that we also probably don't want to be growing on our landscapes or importing. So the lard turned out to be this really phenomenal, you know, homegrown, sustainable oil that could displace these other oils that are not those things. And so now I use it, and because I also just learned that lard, I make a salve, and I have all these herbs that I infuse into the lard, and then just do this wonderful job of soaking into your skin. And when I was looking into it, I've read that, you know, herbalists from a long way back, you know, back when we used to have this wisdom and knowledge that we would pass down to each other, knew that lard was really good at carrying the medicinal properties of plants into our skin, probably, you know, because pigs aren't that different from us. It's, you know, it's not like they're a poultry or a sheep or a beef cattle. That's just really kind of a different, you know, different animal. We're kind of similar. And, you know, like they can use pig organs when they do organ transplants or whatever in people, you know, it's, there's some commonalities there. And so, like the salves are amazing. The lip balms are amazing because it can really kind of soak into your skin. And yeah. So, and of course, when my kids were babies too, that just, I did the cloth diapers. I made my own baby wipe stuff. And that's when I got into the world of essential oils, really, was when my kids were infants. And I did all that research and learned about all that. And so then that combined with this lard, yeah, it's kind of where all of these different things are born from.
That's awesome. And yeah, so lard is a great base for all that stuff and a really good carrier. And you do make candles with it too, right?
Yes. And I do the candles because I have, so I have beeswax, and I was sad because when I make soap, I have to use some really harsh chemicals. So it's not something that I could really do with my children. But the candles are, you know, you're just melting things together and pouring them in, and it's just lard and beeswax. That's all it is. And it's just in a cute little tin, but it's something that we all can kind of do. And what I'm really hoping is that I can, continue the soaps and salves and lip balms are under the name Good Fat Skincare. And then the candles I call fat burners.
I love that.
I think the small candle burns 625 calories every time you know, once it's done. So you can feel good about that.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm hoping that my kids will take an interest and they could, you know, there's a lot of opportunity and potential there if you want to put the time and effort into the marketing and, you know, going and telling everybody about how great they are. Like, you know, like what we're kind of doing right now. I'm hoping one of them will kind of take it and maybe develop it into something bigger than what it currently is.
That's awesome. That would be a really cool opportunity for them and a way to kind of stretch their entrepreneurial muscles and maybe earn some extra money.
Right, exactly. But without having to use lye all the time, because I can I can do that part.
Yeah, exactly. The lye is kind of the scary part.
Yes, it is.
So let's talk about Burger Night real quick. I know my husband and I and our children have been out to Burger Night and it's fabulous. Like, it is so much fun. And around here, pizza night was a big thing before I heard about Burger Night. So tell me kind of how you guys came up with Burger Night and what all it involves.
Well, so the cheese thing fell apart, right? And the cheese thing that I wanted to do, the reason I loved it so much is because of all the people that I got to interact with. So when I was on my little path of self-discovery and, you know, realized I should really be working in my strengths if we want this to be a sustainable business, that I knew that I wanted there to be a community type aspect to it. And I think I knew, you know, this dream developed a really long time ago, so it's really hard to remember how it all came together. But I think I might have known about some of the on-farm events going on already. And like, pizza night sounds cool and it's good, but you know, if you look at a pizza, if you put all the meat into a little pile, it's not very much meat, you know. And we are a meat focused operation. Most of the other on-farm events and pizza nights and stuff are usually not. They're usually more of a vegetable based operation. And of course, dough, like me and dough have never gotten along. Like, I just can't do it. I'm not good at it. I've tried repeatedly and just been frustrated. So I knew right away that pizzas were not really meant for us. But burgers, of course, are meat centric and can be just as diverse and use lots of really great other local products and fresh ingredients the same way that you can do with pizzas. And the other beautiful part is my lard could go into the fryers because even though I was making all the soap and stuff, there still is a lot and it's constantly coming in. And until I have like a little soap making, you know, building, I just can't increase production significantly more at this, you know, working full time and doing all that. So the fryers use the lard and then the beef. And then of course we do like a shredded pork, like, we can make anything we want now because we have this huge commercial kitchen that we can do all of this out of. So it became quickly apparent that pizzas wouldn't work for us, but that burgers and fries and cheese curds would be perfect and still accomplish all the same goals, right? Of using lots of different local pool ingredients, lots of different flavors. I mean, you can put anything on a burger, really. So we've been, so that's been growing. We did some test runs in 2017 to see if it was a good idea and if we should, you know, make this huge investment into the commercial kitchen and, you know, all the other requirements. And it went really well. And so then we decided to do it. The other thing that had to happen is we really had to kind of meet all the right people. I think Burger Night was an idea in my mind for probably 5 or 6 years before all the people kind of came into place that could help us do it. Because, of course, one of the benefits to doing pizzas is that you can just cook the pizzas and just don't burn the crust and just melt the cheese and get everything good. And that's, you know, that's kind of the extent of the cooking knowledge that you have to have, right? I mean, yes, you got to make all of your ingredients and they have to taste great. And there's all that. But when it comes to just cooking, it's a little bit different with burgers because, you know, people want them at the right temperature. You have to control the grill. You have to control the fryers. Like, it really takes somebody that can work in a fast-paced kitchen environment to really be able to do it. So it's not something that my husband or I can do. We have to hire staff, kitchen staff, to help us. And until the farm-to-table restaurants opened up in Eau Claire, which would have been 3 years ago, we didn't really have any kitchen or chef friends. But once we started selling meat to those places, then we had lots of chef and kitchen friends. And they're, I don't know, kitchen staff are just really amazing people. They tend to really just have really big hearts and really want to see everyone, you know, be successful. And they never get paid well. And they're always overworked and long hours. But they're always just a really genuinely nice and great supportive people. And they've been, we couldn't have done any of it without their help and without their help even now. Just, you know, I still feel like we're kind of in a startup phase with it. So did I answer your question? I don't remember what you asked.
Yeah, and you guys have music out there and you have like a little beer area and lots of like games and stuff for kids to play. And you can walk around and like pet the animals. Like, I know when we were there, at least my daughter got to touch one of the baby cows and it was just like totally made her day.
And we have George the rooster, who is a big Cochin rooster, who's super sweet. And he walks around and he sees if anybody has any leftover french fries that they want to share with him. He won't get close enough for you to touch him, but he'll get really pretty close if you want him to.
She likes to chase him too. She pretty much followed him everywhere. Every time she saw him, like she just had to follow him.
But yeah, you know, the whole reason we started into this farming world and good food and meats, and I mean, was because of my children. And of course, and we have their playsets and we have just all, of course we want it to be family friendly. And also, you know, the happier I can keep everybody, the less they'll notice how long it's taking for their food to come out, which sometimes can be, you know, 45 minutes or something. But we have live music every Friday and Saturday. We have our bar. I think the last time I checked, I think we have 20 different beers and 20 different wines. A lot of the beer, all the tap beers are local out of Eau Claire and Menominee. And yeah, you know, again, it's just trying to really support the community of food and well beverage producers in the area, because it is a really small world. And, you know, once you're in it, you kind of know everybody, which is great. So yeah, so I try to keep the kids as happy as I can, because then mom and dad can have as much fun as they want.
Oh yeah, totally. And that's, we found like, you know, the time flies when you're there, but it's nice to spend time sitting outside, like playing, just relaxing. Like you said, you don't even really notice how long it takes, and it didn't take that long, but you just are having a good time. And it's nice to be able to relax out there and enjoy the view and the animals and all that. And one of the things I noticed is you don't,
well,
it's not like, like with having animals, sometimes, especially like the more concentrated animal farms have a really like bad smell. And I think that's not what you experience out there. And you get to see how much like room the animals have to run around. And I don't know.
Right.
It's really different.
Right. It's never good to have too much of anything in one place.
Totally. So we got to wrap up now, but I have a few last questions for you. What is your wild dream or wild goal of 2019?
Well, I already took the first step of the wild 2019 dream, and that was quitting the day job after 15 years, and it's a long time. And so that was just like 2 weeks ago. So now
that's amazing.
My pretty wild dream now is making it work and not having to go get another off-farm job. And that's where I could use your help.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be great. I can't wait to finish all the projects I started and all these, like, you know, I want to make the freezer meals into a subscription. I want to do a different bundle of meat on sale each week that matches a weekly, like, meal plan that I'm going to put together, and then the meat will be on sale, and then you'll know exactly what you're making and doing. So successful on the farm full time is my big wild dream for 2019.
That is fantastic. And I have a feeling that that's going to happen for you. So who inspires you?
Who inspired me? Well, I think that my grandpa was a really big inspiration. You know, I've mentioned the cheese factory and stuff a few times, and it was, our factory was one of the longest owned, family owned operations. And one of the reasons that we didn't go out of business when all of these other small cheese factories did, which you probably see them when you drive around all over the place, is because grandpa kind of had a hunch that it would be smarter to make mozzarella cheese than cheddar cheese, because he really thought that the pizza thing was going to take off over on the East Coast of the country, New York. And he was right, right? So I would say that pizza has done a pretty good job of being successful. And so because he chose to go into mozzarella instead of cheddar, that was one of the biggest reasons the family business could continue for as long as it did. So kind of, you know, with our farm, it's a very untraditional farm. We are really bucking a lot of convention and a lot of, you know, a lot of the neighbors think we're crazy. And a lot of them come out for burger night, I think more to just be nosy than maybe because they want to support burger night. But they just want to see, like, what is going on over here. And then, of course, with burger night, I thought we were kind of the only farm. I tried to Google as much as I could. Are there any other farms doing burger night? Like, is there anybody I can learn from or see what they're doing, talk to? And I could not find any. But actually, I just learned about one in Vermont. So there is one other place that is doing burger night. But yeah, so I think just the willingness, even though you're putting your business, you're putting everything that you worked for so long on the line, you know, if you just keep doing what everyone else is doing, you're going to end up at the same place everyone else is going to end up. And that's not always a very pretty picture. So we're taking some pretty significant risks financially and as a family, but I am optimistic that they will all start paying back and will turn out to be really great decisions in a few years. And I'll forget how scared I even was, like, because it just will have all come together and made so much sense. So yeah, so I see my grandpa as a really big inspiration, and my mom too, because my mom grew up in some pretty tough situations and she was in some pretty hard situations and had to also make some really, really difficult decisions to do the hard thing, because oftentimes, you know, you have to do the hard thing in order for it to be the right thing, right? To be the best for you ultimately. So she's also been pretty amazing to look at. It's just, you know, when it comes to your parents, it's hard because you're so close to them. And it's not until you're older and you can look back, be like, wow, that was pretty amazing what you did. And I'm sorry I didn't recognize it at the time. So a couple of direct family influences, I guess.
I love that. And so final question, what does the word nourish mean to you?
Well, to me, the word nourish is really the whole person, I guess. Is when I think of nourishing, I think of body, mind, spirit, just more than just your physical well-being. Because you can be the fittest, happiest, or you can be the fittest, physically fit person, but you can still be miserable and unhappy and unfulfilled. And I think we don't do enough in our culture to kind of slow down and appreciate what's around us. And I, of course, am just as guilty of that as anybody else. And that's one of my huge things that I want to do now that I'm not working two full-time jobs is to be more present and to slow down and appreciate and love the farm, my family, our customers, you know, to move out of this place of like stress and chaos and really just, you know, just be present and be okay. And, you know, that's one of the other benefits to you guys coming here is you're not in your own yard. And so like when you're in your own yard, like I have to apologize oftentimes when people come because I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, this is so messy. And oh, we just had such a bad winter. And that's why there's all this mud and water here. And we're going to fix it. But nobody even notices any of that until I point it out and apologize for it. So I have to learn to like be good with where we're at in the process of things. And, you know, kind of embrace it because it's just all part of this big journey. And you really notice that once you start looking at where you've been, you know, and how far you've come and everything you've accomplished. And so to me, I'm going to spend a lot of time now in the next short period of time really working on nourishing myself and not just eating well and doing better, but just spiritually and, you know, emotionally, because us moms, we can really put some major burdens on ourselves to look. I mean, Supermom 8428, she's amazing on Instagram and like she can do it all, but yeah, that doesn't mean I have to do that. So, yeah. So getting to that place.
I love that. So I know people are going to want to learn more about the farm and learn more about you. In what ways should they connect with you and how do they find out more about the farm?
Well, the website, so togetherfarms.com. So it's all one word and it's plural. I am trying to learn Instagram. I'm not trying to be Supermom 2848, but I do know that people want to see what's going on. And I'm going to try to do a good job of maybe not like creating content, but just kind of documenting what's going on here. And so that people can feel like they know us and, you know, like they're on a farm tour every day. So that's my goal with Instagram and with Facebook too, is to do a lot more of kind of everyday life and sharing. And of course, teaching and recipes, and just sharing everything we have and everything I've learned so far to get to where we're at. And of course, to see where we go. So Facebook is just Together Farms, as is Instagram. And then of course, people can call me or text me or whatever. I have a blog. It's been really touch and go, of course, the last couple of years, but that's something again that I hope to develop a lot more moving forward. And so people can search the blog and try to find stuff too, but they can always text me or call me. And my number is all over. And that's just 715-210-4740.
Perfect. And I can put all of that in the show notes as well. So thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been such a pleasure. I hope everyone will come out for burger night and check you guys out and try your amazing meat. And I love all the knowledge you share. And I think you have such a fantastic journey and like story of just following your heart, following your instincts, taking the risks and making it happen.
Thank you so much for listening to Nourish and Shine. I hope that you enjoy this episode and that you'll leave me a review on iTunes so that more people can hear the podcast. I'd also love to connect with you on social media. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I would love to hear your questions, so please send them my way. Also, you can check out my website. It's amysopola.com. I hope that today's interview provided you with some inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and to live a whole, vibrant life. Please join me again next week for another amazing interview. Have a wonderful week. The information provided on this podcast is for educational purposes only. It's not intended to diagnose or treat any disease or condition. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your medical provider.